ladies and gentlemen, Joseph Gaines.
Dawn, my secret's out. It's appropriate after 16 years or whatever it has been that I'm here, that at the one about who done it, you've discovered I'm a fraud. I'm sorry. Point is, no one took me seriously when I was a Nebraska farm boy, and I had to do something drastic, and it's worked so far until Kevin's just given the game away. So I may as well be honest here and say also I've never been to prison. I mean, it's confession time now. Yeah. And I've never even been to England, truth be told. But if you, there's a great work of fiction out there called Race with the Devil, if you want to go and buy that. And talking about works of fiction, my wife and children, who don't really exist either, no one's seen them. If you notice that, I've been coming 16 years, no one's ever seen my wife and children. You notice that? But although they don't exist, they are starving. So please do spend loads of money at my book table, because then I can take it home to my farm in Nebraska and feed my fictional wife and children. Okay, enough of me. G.K. Chesterton. And when I discovered that the theme for this was going to be detective fiction or whodunit, I told Lou that I would like to speak on the detective who was Thursday. Because The Man Who Was Thursday is a detective story, and it actually was published 2 years before the first of the Father Brown stories, published in 1908. And I've been teaching The Man Who Was Thursday for many years at college level. I love it. It's one of my favorite novels. But I find that this is where I get the opportunity to disagree with G.K. Chesterton and to prove, this is the mystery story here, prove that G.K. Chesterton does not know what he's talking about. At least on one topic, which is this novel, The Man Who Was Thursday. Now, this is a dangerous thing for me to be saying, because I have made a major point that we need to read an author's work objectively. In other words, we don't read it as a subjective, relativistic experience where I take my pride and prejudice to the text, I do what I want with the text, I see what I want to see and refuse to see what I don't want to see, and just make the work of literature reflect my own prejudices. That's what we mustn't do. So we need to read objectively. Now, the only perfect objectivity in understanding a work of literature is the perspective that God has of it and of its author. He understands it perfectly. No one else does, including the author. But, so we can't read a work objectively perfectly any more than we can read reality objectively perfectly. But we have to aspire towards and do our best to understand reality as objectively as possible. Now, in reading a work of literature, that means we need to begin by reading it through somebody's eyes other than our own, at least at first. And then there's a hierarchy of authority as regards who we should take seriously with regard to the author of a work. So you can read critics. Normally, you'll be reading nonsense, but it's someone else's eyes, someone else's perspective. But the most authoritative reading of a work of literature is that of the author. So we should train ourselves as far as possible to read the work through the authority of the authorial vision of it. So if we want to understand The Man Who Was Thursday, we should try to understand Chesterton. I wrote a book called Through Shakespeare's Eyes, Seeing the Catholic Presence in the Plays, and the whole purpose of that in my previous book, The Quest for Shakespeare, The Bard of Avon, The Church of Rome, showed the biographical evidence for Shakespeare's Catholicism. Why should establish that Shakespeare's a Catholic living in Elizabethan and Jacobean England? The plays are clearly going to be written from the perspective of a Catholic in Elizabethan and Jacobean England. It's not going to be written from the perspective of a Marxist at Yale University. So we have to read through Shakespeare's eyes. So we also need to read Chesterton through Chesterton's eyes. So as someone who's advocating that, what we might call authorialism, as a way of reading literature, it's somewhat dangerous for me to say that Chesterton doesn't know what he's talking about. So I'm going to sort of oscillate between speaking off the cuff about Man of Thursday and just reading from this essay I wrote on, it's called The Nightmare That Wakes Us Up, The Man Who Was Thursday by Chesterton. But I'm going to explain why I don't think Chesterton knows what he's talking about where this novel is concerned. And a lot of you, I hope, are getting very irritated with me now for daring to be arrogant enough to suggest this. So G.K. Chesterton had a low opinion of his own abilities as a novelist. Quote, "My real judgment of my own work," he confessed, "is that I have spoilt a number of jolly good ideas in my time. I think that Napoleon of Notting Hill was a book very well worth writing, but I'm not sure that it was ever written. I think that A Harlequinade, like The Flying Inn, was an extremely promising subject, but I very strongly doubt whether I kept the promise. I'm almost tempted to say that it was still a very promising subject for somebody else." He thought The Bull and the Cross had quite a good plot, based on, quote, "a social suggestion that really has a great deal in it, but I'm much more doubtful about whether I got a great deal out of it." Although, as stories or anecdotes, his fictional works were fresh and personal, his words, quote, "considered as novels, they were not only not as good as a real novelist would have made them, but they were not as good as I might have made them myself, if I had really even been trying to be a real novelist." Chesterton always claimed that he was a jolly journalist. He downplayed his ability as a novelist. There's certainly things wrong with his fiction. But I'm going to disagree with him about that, for starters. I think he's a much better novelist than he gives himself credit for. But let's carry on. "Considering that Chesterton prefaced this confession of failure with an explicit denial that he was indulging in mock modesty, we have little option but to believe that this was indeed his real judgment of his own fictional work. This places the admirer of Chesterton's novels in an awkward position. Do we question Chesterton's judgment, or, eating humble pie, do we question our own? Although eating humble pie is good for us, providing healthy spiritual nourishment, we are nonetheless at liberty to seek further clarification of the reasons for Chesterton's self-deprecatory judgment. Such is provided in his conclusion that he was not able to be a novelist because he had always been a journalist. The fact is that Chesterton wrote everything in haste, as a spontaneous outpouring of his genial and ingenious muse. He wrote his novels in the same manner in which he wrote his essays, at breathtaking speed on the wings of wit and wisdom. One suspects that he seldom stopped to catch his breath or to check his facts, as the flow of words poured forth from his pen. This makes for exhilarating and oft-times exhausting reading, but it also leads, especially in his longer works of fiction, to a degree of negligence with regard to formal considerations of plot consistency and character development. It is for this reason that reading one of Chesterton's novels is like riding a ramshackle roller coaster, so loosely constructed that it seems to teeter on the brink of collapse. And yet we ride the roller coaster in spite of our more pedantic prejudices, because we are doing so in the presence of an indefatigably rambunctious genius. Only a fool would not want to ride such a roller coaster." Now, first mystery story. There is something missing from Chesterton's self-deprecatory judgment of his own novels. Does anybody know what that is? Ah, so we got mystery story, yes. He did not mention The Man Who Was Thursday. Right, I mean, there's actually a wonderful, T.S. Eliot does something very similar in The Wasteland, when he talks about the falling towers, the unreal city, modernity, basically being a transient passing thing. That's not one of the permanent things. And he says, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. These great cities of Western civilization, they're all falling towers and they're all unreal. But what's missing? Rome. Rome is not on the list. Because Rome is not an unreal city. Rome is not a falling tower. Rome is the eternal city. It's the same, you know, using that technique, mystery story technique, not what's there, but what's not there, okay? So what's not in G.K. Chesterton's list of his failure writing novels is any mention of what is definitely his best novel, The Man Who Was Thursday. So, let's see what he says about The Man Who Was Thursday. Not there, but elsewhere. Also in his autobiography, but another part of it. Chesterton's judgment. The title attracted some attention at the time, and there were many journalistic jokes about it. Some, referring to my supposed festive views, affected to mistake it for The Man Who Was Thirsty. Others naturally supposed that Man Thursday was the black brother of Man Friday. Others again, with more penetration, treated it as a mere title out of topsy-turvydom, as if it had been The Woman Who Was Half Past Eight, or The Cow Who Was Tomorrow Evening. But what interested me about it was this, that hardly anybody who looked at the title ever seems to have looked at the subtitle, which was A Nightmare, and the answer to a good many critical questions. Okay, doesn't tell us too much, in fact, except that it's a nightmare. Well, if it's something that's a nightmare, you're not expecting too much reason in it, okay? It's going to be surreal, like a Salvador Dali painting or something, which is not like Chesterton, in fact. I'm going to suggest that the reason that Chesterton does not understand his own novel is he mistakes the inspiration for it, the inspirational, from the aspirational. In other words, what inspired it from what he was aspiring to achieve when he wrote it. Now, allow me to explain. Because when he was a young man at art school, Slade School of Art in London, he went through a phase where he flirted with decadence, flirted with philosophical pessimism, the philosophical ideas of people such as Schopenhauer, the decadent movement of people like Oscar Wilde. You can imagine an art school in the early 1890s would have been full of this stuff. And Chesterton, as a young man, a teenager, was taken in up to a point before recording a horror from it. And it was that experience of the darkness, of despair and nihilism, that was the inspiration for the nightmare that The Man Who Was Thursday is. But when was it written? It was written in 1908. So about 15 or more years after the nightmare that he experienced. And the same year in which he wrote Orthodoxy. So whose eyes should we look at this novel through? The eyes of G.K. Chesterton, the old man, writing in 1936, remembering the novel that he wrote almost 30 years earlier about something that happened 15 years before that. Because we know Chesterton enough, we could be almost sure he never read that novel after it was published. He never read that novel again after he wrote it. So he's remembering a novel. And actually, this illustrates the point. Lou said, in your book, Wisdom and Innocence, my biography of Chesterton, you give the whole initiation ceremony for the Detection Club. It's all in here. Well, he remembered it. He knew what chapter it was in, and he found it. I didn't remember it. And I wrote it. And I'm vain. I reread that book every year. In fact, the reason I don't read anything else is that I've now written so many books, it just keeps me, it takes all my time just reading my own over and over again. So, my argument is that we have to distinguish between the inspirational aspects of the Man of Thursday and the aspirational aspects. What was Chesterton trying to do in 1908? What was he saying in 1908, the same year he wrote Orthodoxy, about what happened to him 15 years earlier? That, so I suggest that we do need to see the novel through Chesterton's eyes. We need to see the novel through the eyes of Chesterton when he was writing it in 1908, not when he was remembering it in 1936. So, again, going back to this, the novel's inspirational source was Chesterton's own experience of the decadence of the 1890s. And he's recoiling in horror from the radical pessimism of fashionable philosophers such as Schopenhauer. Speaking in old age of his experience of such subjectivism, as an impressionable young man, he wrote that, quote, "My eyes were turned inwards rather than outwards, giving my moral personality, I should imagine, a very unattractive squint." Carries on, this is Chesterton. "I was still oppressed with the metaphysical nightmare of negations about mind and matter, with the morbid imagery of evil, with the burden of my own mysterious brain and body. But by this time I was in revolt against them and tried to construct a healthier conception of cosmic life, even if it were one that should err on the side of health. I even called myself an optimist because I was so horribly near to being a pessimist. It is the only excuse I can offer." End quote. This is all from his autobiography. These lines from his autobiography immediately precede Chesterton's discussion of The Man Who Was Thursday, so setting the scene, indicating that the novel grew from the murkiness and mawkishness of the author's doubt-filled adolescence. Quote, "The whole story is a nightmare of things not as they are, but as they seemed to the young half-pessimist of the 90s, and the ogre who appears brutal but is also cryptically benevolent is not so much God, in the sense of religion or irreligion, but rather nature, capital N, as it appears to the pantheist, whose pantheism is struggling out of pessimism. So far as the story had any sense in it, it was meant to begin with the picture of the world at its worst and to work towards the suggestion that the picture was not so black as it was already painted." Okay, so Chesterton's judgment here is that it was a work of optimistic pantheism, and that Sunday in the novel was not God in any religious sense, but sort of nature. Okay, and this is where I am going to disagree with Chesterton and prove Chesterton wrong by reading Chesterton. "Having paid due deference to the authorial voice and its inherent authority, we can now dare to question its veracity. Chesterton was writing this explication of his novel in the mid-30s, shortly before his death, and was failing to place sufficient distance between the inspirational roots of the novel in the decadence and confusion of the 1890s and his own virtuous and settled state of mind at the time that the novel was actually written, 15 years later. Although The Man Who Was Thursday is inspired by the confusion of the previous decade, it aspires to dispel and disperse the clouds of despondency with the piercing light of Christian clarity and charity. It cannot be stressed enough that this critical distance between the inspirational and aspirational aspects of the novel is crucial to our understanding of it. Thursday was written at around the same time that Chesterton was also writing Orthodoxy, his masterpiece of Christian apologetics, both books being published in 1908. And it is perilous to our understanding of the former book if we fail to read it in the light of the latter. So I'm saying if you want to read The Man Who Was Thursday through Chesterton's eyes, the authorial voice, we have to see through the eyes of the Chesterton who wrote Orthodoxy, not the old man who's remembering writing it 30 years later. The aging Chesterton, recalling Thursday in the light of the darkness of his youth across the span of 40 years, makes the perilous mistake of seeing the dragon of decadence and not the knight in shining orthodoxy who slays it. Thus, in his autobiography, he writes that, quote, "The monstrous pantomime ogre who was called Sunday in the story is not so much God, but rather nature as it appears to the pantheist, whose pantheism is struggling out of pessimism," end quote. Whereas, in fact, as the text testifies explicitly, Sunday refers to himself within the context of the book of Genesis and the days of creation as, quote, "the Sabbath" and, quote, "the peace of God." And, as if to hammer the point home, his final words are those of Christ himself, asking his interlocutors, "Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of?" Daring to disagree with Chesterton, whose myopic memory misreads his own novel, Sunday reveals himself as being much more than mere nature, much more than a mere God, but the Christian God, whose presence makes sense of the nightmare nonsense that his perceived absence presents. Seeing Thursday in the contemporaneous light of orthodoxy and its ethics of Elfland, we can see that it encapsulates the paradox embodied in the character of Chesterton's delightful priest detective, Father Brown, that wisdom can only be found in innocence. This is nothing less than the truth that Christ teaches. We will not be with him in heaven unless we become as little children. All right, so having it hopefully established what I'm trying to say here by quoting, I'm disagreeing with Chesterton, but I'm only disagreeing with Chesterton because I'm agreeing with Chesterton who's disagreeing with Chesterton. I hope that gets me off the hook. But I want to look at orthodoxy in the light of, look at Man Who Was Thursday in the light of orthodoxy, first of all, and look at the text of the novel, which Chesterton clearly had not read since he wrote it. First of all, at the beginning, we have the two adversaries, Gabriel Simon, Lucian Gregory. Doesn't take an awful lot of literary critical nous to see a suggestion between an archangel and another archangel, one of whom is an angel of light, Gabriel, and the other, Lucian, Lucifer, an angel of darkness. And this shouldn't surprise us, because a little while later in his novel, The Ball and the Cross, the novel begins and ends with a Professor Lucifer, who's a mad scientist, and a monk called Brother Michael. So this is a technique, obviously, Chesterton uses. Now, I don't want to go into too much of this. I want to just dip into the text for the remainder of the talk. So, students, I can't help but imagine I'm back in the classroom now, so pick out your books, go to page 44, okay? I'm going to say it by accident anyway, so I may as well confess it. You're just my students now. I hope you did the reading assignment so you know what I'm talking about, okay? It might be on the test, so listen. So we hear that the policeman, this mysterious policeman, talking to Sime. He's talking about we've had long been an opinion that a purely intellectual conspiracy would soon threaten the very existence of civilization. He, that's the chief of police, is certain that the scientific and artistic worlds are silently abound in a crusade against the family and the state. He has, therefore, formed a special corps of policemen who are also philosophers, and they're being recruited for an investigation which is also a heresy hunt. He carries on. "The ordinary detective goes to pothouses to arrest thieves. We go to artistic tea parties to detect pessimists. The ordinary detective discovers from a ledger or a diary that a crime has been committed. We discover from a book of sonnets that a crime will be committed. We have to trace the origin of those dreadful thoughts that drive men on at last to intellectual fanaticism and intellectual crime." And then Sime says, "Do you mean that there's really as much connection between crime and the modern intellect as all that?" At which point this mysterious policeman gives a whole history of intellectual crime, from Roman emperors through to Machiavelli, etc., etc. And of course, this is absolutely true. You look at intellectual crime, look at what people such as Karl Marx has done, his ideas. The ideas of Karl Marx has led directly to the killing of tens of millions of people. Indirectly, he's the largest serial killer in human history because of his poisonous ideas and what those poisonous ideas inspired. The idea of Superman, the Übermensch, of Nietzsche, was one of the inspirations for the rise of the Nazi Party. Again, millions of people killed because of bad ideas. And we could go on, but I think we get the point. And the point that Chesterton's trying to get us to understand here. And then we've got possibly my favourite part of the novel, when he gives three... This is a detective fiction story, detective novel. Oh, by the way, I'm breaking all the rules and I'm going to hell, but to hell with it. Because in these two pages here, turn to them, right? Pages 84 to 85, Chesterton gives us three clues about who Sunday is. And it is he's a very good detective story, because certainly the first several times I've read this, I didn't see those clues until they hit me in the face. And I'm sure it's true of most people, because most people finish reading this book and certainly they haven't done it in the context of a classroom, completely and utterly confused. Well, that was great, but what on earth was it about? So people don't get the clues, but look, and they're so close together. Just in two pages, three crucial clues. So they're talking about Sunday. Did you know, he asked, that this man Gogol was one of us? In other words, a policeman in disguise, pretending to be a follower of Sunday. I? No, I didn't know it, answered Syme in some surprise. But didn't you? I knew no more than the dead, replied the man who called himself De Worms. I thought the president was talking about me. I ratted in my boots. And I thought he was talking about me, said Syme, with his reckless, rather reckless laughter. I had my hand on my revolver all the time. So had I, said the professor grimly. So had Gogol, evidently. Okay, first clue. Second clue. We were three, he said. If we had been 300, we could still have done nothing. Not if we were 300 against four, asked Syme, jeering rather boisterously. No, said the professor with sobriety, not if we were 300 against Sunday. Right. Third clue. And he remarked this difference between Sunday and all his satellites, that their faces, however fierce or sinister, became gradually blurred by memory, like other human faces, whereas Sunday seemed almost to grow more actual during absence, as if a man's painted portrait should slowly come alive. Three clues, not actually over two pages. I started reading there, I ended reading there, in under one page, three clues given to us, which none of us get. Because in the first, the fact that all of them thought that Sunday knew they were the imposter, they were the spy, all of them simultaneously thought the same thing, suggests that Sunday has the power of omniscience. He knows everything. The second one, if there were three against him, against we have been 300, have made no difference. What, 300 against four, says Science? Not if we were 300 against Sunday. But then it doesn't matter how many of us there are, none of us can defeat him. It's the attribute of omnipotence. He's all powerful. Second clue. Now the third one. The difference between Sunday and all his satellites, that their faces, however fierce or sinister, became gradually blurred by memory like other human faces, whereas Sunday seemed almost to grow more actual during absence, as if a man's painted portrait should slowly come alive. All worded very creepily, but what's been talked about there is his omnipresence. He's always present, never absent. So we have there, in the space of one page, three clues, each of which marks Sunday out as having one of the three divine attributes of omniscience, omnipotence and omnipresence. And he's such a great detective story writer, Chesterton, that none of us see it. So immediately below, to throw us off the scent, Syme, who of course we sympathise with, he's the protagonist, we like him. And it's Syme that says, "Therefore I swear by God that I will seek out this man, whom I fear, until I find him, and strike him on the mouth. If heaven were his throne and the earth his footstool, I swear that I would pull him down." So Syme, who we like, is basically saying that man's got demonic power. All of a sudden, all the clues are forgotten, we move on. All right, then move on. Turn now to page 154, please. Time. Okay, so now they're facing Sunday, they're asking direct questions. Who are you? What are you? Why did you get us all here? Do you know who and what we are? Are you a half-witted man playing a conspirator, or are you a clever man playing the fool? Answer me, I tell you. Direct question for Sunday. How does Sunday answer? He says, well, I'm not going to tell you, but yeah, basically. He says, if you want to know one what you are, I'll tell you who you are a set of highly well-intentioned young jackasses. I'll tell you what you are, because this is the six philosophers, right? They're in pursuit of the truth. They're in pursuit of the truth and not very good at it because they're full of bad ideas. But they're well-intentioned young jackasses. It's the pursuing God ignorantly. And you, said Simon, what are you? Demanding an answer. I. What am I? Roared the president. And he rose slowly to an incredible height, like some enormous wave about to arch above them and break. You want to know what I am, do you? Bull, you are a man of science. Grub in the roots of those trees and find out the truth about them. Sign, you are a poet. Stare at those morning clouds. But I tell you this, that you will have found out the truth of the last tree and the topmost cloud before the truth about me. You will understand the sea, and I shall be still a riddle. You shall know what the stars are and not know what I am. Since the beginning of the world, all men have hunted me like a wolf. Kings and sages and poets and lawgivers, all the churches and all the philosophers. And I have never been caught yet. And the skies will fall in the time I turn to bay. I've given them a good run for their money, and I will now. And then he runs away. All right, so basically all the philosophers, all the poets, all the wise men have been searching for him since the beginning of time. And we can know the last secret of science. All there is to know about the physical cosmos, and we will not understand him. We will not know him. Because, of course, the one thing that's necessary, and this, again, this is profoundly orthodox. Remember when Chesterton's writing this, right? 1908. This is profoundly orthodox. That reason, philosophy, can only take us so far. Yes, we can understand that if there's not a chaos at the core of the cosmos, there has to be order. There's order, there's probably a God. And there's probably not many gods. Probably one God, because otherwise there'd be anarchy. They're fighting each other. We can come to that. We can sort of see through reason that God must be omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. Because if he's not those things, he's not God. So in other words, reason will take us so far. But if we want to understand God beyond that, what do we need?
Revelation.
God has to reveal himself to us if we will know him more than mere reason. But here, of course, Sunday here, is a playful God. And he runs away. Not only does he run away, but this, again, it's the great detective stories. So just turn over. Following pages, as he runs away, he's sort of throwing clues behind him from balloons and the tops of elephants and what have you. Throwing balloons, and miraculously, they all find their way to the person that they're addressed to. So let's look at some of these clues. So the first clue is to Dr. Ball, one of the philosophers. What about Martin Tupper now? Who knows who Martin Tupper is? Yeah, you would. You're not allowed. Dale's not allowed to tell us who Martin Tupper is. But I don't know how Dale found out, but I found out because there is one other God in the universe, and that's Almighty Google. And I Googled it. And Martin Tupper was a sort of blithely bland optimist of the Victorian period. And Ball in the book is an optimist, right? He always tries to see the bright side of things. So what about Martin Tupper now? In other words, what about your optimism now? Isn't it shallow? Isn't it facile? Did it get you anywhere? So again, Chesterton's a brilliant detective story writer because the first clue makes sense. Right, she's got us hooked. And then the next clue. Fly at once, the truth about your trouser stretches is known. A friend. Okay, what on earth is that about, right? How is that a clue? The truth about my trouser stretches is known? I'm sure fly at once has to be a pun as well, right? Presumably, I don't know. But so we got more clues. And in the midst of these clues, by the way, we have this. Syme's impression of running through the zoo. Syme felt a glaring panorama of the strange animals in the cages which they passed. Afterwards, he thought it queer that he should have seen them so clearly. He remembered especially seeing pelicans with their preposterous pendant throats. He wondered why the pelican was the symbol of charity, except it was that it wanted a good deal of charity to admire a pelican. He remembered a hornbill, which was simply a huge yellow beak with a small bird tied on behind it. The whole gave him a sensation, the vividness of which he could not explain, that nature was always making quite mysterious jokes. Sunday had told them that they would understand him when they had understood the stars. He wondered whether even the archangels understood the hornbill. So this understanding that God has a sense of humour, right? He's an artist, he's a creator, with a, not just gravitas, but levitas, with a light touch, a lightheartedness, a joy. God laughs. And then the last two clues, which are marvellous, because we don't get them again. And they're obvious once you see them. So the penultimate clue is, the word I fancy should be pink. Right, so you've got, that's obvious, right? You know, well, that's clear. And the one afterwards, the final one. When the herring runs a mile, let the secretary smile. When the herring tries to fly, let the secretary die. Rustic proverb. Herrings. Detective stories. The previous clue. The word I fancy should be pink. All of these clues are pink herrings, right? They lead us nowhere except to distract us from the real criminal, the mystery. Who are we really looking for? And again, you know, that the astral of the hornbill, it's no surprise it's Chesterton that says that angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. And the devil falls by his own gravity, by taking himself too seriously. God can fly because he takes himself lightly. All right, I'm going to cut to the chase, if you see, now. Get towards the end of the novel. And this actually ties in very much with what Dale said in his talk, by the way, about the tapestry. Remember, we see from the back of the tapestry. Listen to me, cried Syme. Well, before that, Syme says, I knew that he was only like a father playing hide-and-seek with his children. Sundays are like a father playing hide-and-seek with his children. Listen to me, cried Syme with extraordinary emphasis. Shall I tell you the secret of the whole world? It is that we have only known the back of the world. We see everything from behind, and it looks brutal. That is not a tree. but the back of a tree. That is not a cloud, but the back of a cloud. Cannot you see that everything is stooping and hiding a face? If we could only get round in front. So again, this understanding you see a lot in C.S. Lewis, that this is the shadowlands. But the fullness of reality is not seen until we get beyond the shadowlands, beyond the land of shadows, to the reality, which is heaven. That's when we'll understand. If only we could see things from God's side. If only we could have a God's eye view and not a man's eye view of things. In a Platonic sense, if we could see things as God sees in their form, and not in sort of the accidental aspects of that form which we see in what we call reality, the essence of things, the being, their being. It's a deep philosophy. If I had more time, I'd connect that to Hopkins and Inscape and Hecataeus, put you all to sleep. But we won't. When we won't. So they find themselves in a garden. And someone pointed out to me, I can't remember who it was actually, someone pointed out to me this weekend how, where was it now? If it comes to me. But they all agreed that in this garden, where they've all been given a name, which is the day of the week, which they are, but they have a costume, which relates to the book of Genesis, the creation narrative of the book of Genesis. They all agreed that in some unaccountable way, the place reminded them of their boyhood. It was either this elm top or that crooked path. It was either this scrap of orchard or that shape of a window. But each man of them declared that he could remember this place before he could remember his mother. They're being taken to a place of primal innocence where they could become like little children so they can enter into the kingdom of heaven. Right near the end here. 179, please. This is Sunday speaking. I seem to remember only centuries of heroic war, in which you were always heroes. Epic on epic, Iliad on Iliad, and you always brothers in arms, whether it was but recently, for time is nothing, or at the beginning of the world, I sent you out to war. So this idea of the quest for truth being part of the church militant, it's we are homo viator, we're men on a journey, the journey is to get to heaven, and it's a war against the dragon. We have to be heroic. We either fight the dragon or we become the dragon. There's no middle path. The quest for truth as a war against falsehood, lies. And then, who and what are you? He's asked the question again, but this time he gives an answer. I am the Sabbath. I am the peace of God. And then they all misunderstand him. Right? They always argue, what does that mean? Right? What's the peace of God mean? And the real anarchist turns up. Lucian Gregory comes back again. Yes, Sir Gregory, the great and dangerous restraint. I am the real anarchist. And he's basically talking about, look at all the suffering in the world. How dare you call yourself the peace of God when all the suffering there is in the world? And Simon said, oh, I could forgive you everything, you that warm mankind, if I could feel for once that you had suffered for 1 hour a real agony such as I. And Simon springs to his feet, shaking from head to foot. I see everything, he cried. Everything that there is. We have suffered too. And we don't despair. Just because you've suffered does not give you the right to be a nihilist. Does not give you a right to be an anarchist. We suffer and we still believe in virtue. But there's still one unanswered question. And he gets to it right at the end. Have you, turning to Sunday, have you, he cried in a dreadful voice, have you ever suffered? And the answer is, can ye drink of the cup that I drink of? Sorry, old man Chesterton. Young man Chesterton wrote a profoundly Christian and orthodox work of literature. Thank you.